What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
News that Israel and Hamas both signed onto a peace agreement reached Gaza last night.
Just being able to sleep without worrying about my family or my friends feels unbelievable.
I want to go out. I want to continue my study. I want to live my life.
But ahead, there's plenty of uncertainty.
I think the biggest issue will be the prisoner exchange.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, the meaning of this milestone on the path to peace in the Middle East.
Plus, the effort to stop illegal gold mining in Peru.
And in the wilds of Costa Rica, bugs used to be everywhere.
There were so many insects that we had to establish a tent in our living room to work inside of at night.
Why that has all changed.
Today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. It was late last night when the news arrived in Gaza.
For a few seconds, my mind froze. I couldn't process it.
Mohammed Akluk was in bed in the city of Deir al-Balah. He'd just been on our show talking about the relentless fighting and displacement over the past 2 years that his family had endured.
I woke my wife. I said to her, the war's over. She looked at me in a strange way, confused, and she told me, what you are talking about? It's the middle of the night. There is no news. I said, no, but Trump just announced it. The war is over.
Disbelief, disorientation, those were some of the earliest reactions to the announcement that Israel and Hamas had signed on to the first phase of a 20-point peace agreement proposed by the U.S. There has also been celebration. Hostage Square in Tel Aviv erupted with music and dancing. This man spoke through an interpreter.
So he just turned on the TV and he understood something is going on and he just felt he must come here.
But let's start today with the actual agreement. For more on that, we turn to Shashank Joshi, defense editor for The Economist.
What's been agreed is a ceasefire and then an Israeli military withdrawal that will still leave it in control of about half of the Gaza Strip. At the same time, we will then see a countdown begin, and at the end of that, it's about 72 hours, Hamas must release all 20 of the live hostages that they hold, and of course the bodies of the others will then follow, although they say they may not be able to locate all of them. Israel will also release, I think it's 250 Palestinian prisoners who are serving life sentences in jails and about 1,700 detainees from Gaza. So in other words, these are people, not, I think most of them not convicted of anything. And so that prisoner swap is an absolutely integral part of this. Aid will flow into Gaza. Aid, I think, that is going to be equivalent to the amount that flowed during a ceasefire earlier this year. And then is the tricky part, which is much less detailed, which is negotiations over the latter phases of the deal, which fundamentally involve changes to the status of Gaza, who is going to run Gaza, the status of Hamas, and ultimately negotiations over a two-state solution.
Right. So this is what a 20-point plan. Without getting into all of those, can we expand a little bit on what the bigger picture is here, of which this is just the beginning?
Yes. I mean, I think the fundamental element is the demilitarization of Gaza, which includes not just the disarmament of Hamas, but also the destruction of what is described in the statement as military terror and offensive infrastructure. So, for example, that would include the extensive network of Hamas tunnels underneath the Gaza Strip. There's also a big political component. Gaza is to be governed by a committee of technocrats, a group of Palestinian technocrats, and that's transitional, and they will be supervised by what's described as a board of peace. And the chair of that board, the head of that board, is Donald Trump. It will involve Tony Blair, the former Prime Minister of the UK, who has for a long time served as the envoy of a number of international actors towards the Palestinians. And eventually, Gaza would be handed over to the Palestinian Authority, the PA. That's the entity that currently runs the West Bank. And Hamas would have no role in that. But all of those details are left completely open and subject to negotiations. And I think that there is some skepticism that actually all of that will really happen in practice.
Right. So the hostage release, the prisoner release, the flowing of aid back into Gaza, those have all actually been agreed to between Hamas and Israel. The rest of the things you outlined, that is part of a plan, but it has not been agreed to by those two parties. Is that correct?
That's correct. There's all sorts of sticking points. And I think in some ways, both sides have agreed in the anticipation they will be able to shape those details to their advantage. So, for example, Hamas in the past has said they would not lay down their weapons. They would only do so if a Palestinian state is established. I think there are some debates inside Hamas as well, right? They have they operate by consensus. They are split between their military wing in Gaza, their political wing abroad. And some of them might feel, well, we'll give up our rockets, but we won't give up our guns. So I think there's a kind of interesting debate there. There's also, of course, a significant opposition within the Israeli establishment over any involvement of the Palestinian Authority in Gaza. The PA is seen as kind of a weak, ineffectual entity that is too supportive of violent extremism. And I think there are many, many people in Israel who would be firmly opposed to that kind of further involvement by the PA.
What has actually changed on the ground so far in Gaza?
The honest answer is very little. The Israel Defense Forces inside Gaza had begun winding down operations. You know, they were destroying tunnels, but they were avoiding major offensive operations. I think all of that will basically grind to a halt. And regardless of, you know, anything else, the IDF is really going to stop because at the very least, they'll be waiting for everything to sort of work itself out. The aid trucks will be getting into place and they'll be moving. They'll be identifying which Palestinian prisoners they will be releasing. Hamas will be working furiously to work out exactly where all the hostages are and perhaps where some of the bodies of these people are as well. So all in all, I think that there will be a huge amount of activity, but it'll be a very, very nervous time. And I think the thing to remember here, of course, is Hamas is not the only militant actor in Gaza. There are others. There's Palestinian Islamic Jihad. There's other groups. And I think there will be concern over whether all armed factions on the ground will abide by the terms of what has been agreed, because that could, you know, easily cause a crisis or an incident that results in Israel then striking back.
Right. So concern about whether Hamas can actually enforce a ceasefire or prisoner exchange when there are so many different factions and militias within Gaza.
Well, I think the biggest issue will be the prisoner exchange. We don't fully know whether Hamas is in complete control of all the hostages. I think by and large, they can probably deliver on this, but there will also then be a really intense debate in Israel and between Israel and Hamas over which Palestinian prisoners are released, because, of course, many in Israel don't want to release those who have Israeli blood on their hands, but that is the case for many of the prisoners who will have to be released.
What is pushing Hamas and Israel to comply with this agreement? And what happens if they don't? I mean, we've seen these agreements fall apart before.
I mean, I think it's two words. The first is Donald and the second is Trump. Of course, there are other factors here. Hamas is, you know, exhausted, battered on its last legs, has suffered gravely, but it still has, you know, its militant wing still has 10,000 fighters, according to Israeli intelligence sources, and its elite forces are still, you know, muster up 1,000 or so people. So it's not completely out. On the Israeli side, of course, you know, anyone who's followed Israeli politics will see that there is a major public support for a deal to release the hostages. There is weariness of this campaign. Reservists have fought in this war for many hundreds of days in some cases. Hostages families are a powerful political force. There have been big demonstrations in Tel Aviv and other cities against the government of Benjamin Netanyahu. And so all of that plays a role. But I think when you boil it down, it is the intense pressure of Donald Trump and his willingness to sort of knock heads that has probably played a role in this. One of the threats was if this wasn't signed, we saw Donald Trump saying very clearly that he would allow Israel to pursue this war with no limits. And I'm sure that concentrated some minds in Hamas as well.
Shashank Joshi is the defense editor for The Economist. Later in the hour, we will hear reactions from Israel and Gaza to this peace plan news.
When an American company hires a foreign employee, that person needs a visa to live and work in the U.S. Often it's an H-1B visa. It used to cost a few thousand dollars to apply, but President Trump revamped the H-1B program last month, and now the fee has jumped to $100,000. The bulk of H-1B visa holders historically come from India, and as Priyanka Shankar explains, young people on the subcontinent are now thinking twice about building careers in the U.S.
I'm standing at the entrance of Electronic City, the information technology hub of India's Silicon Valley, Bengaluru. This area of the city houses the country's top multinational tech firms who often send their employees to the United States to work on cutting-edge technology. The Indian workers apply for a visa called the H-1B, which gives them the right to work and live in the U.S. for 3 years, after which the visa can be renewed for a maximum of 6 years. Every year, 65,000 H-1B visas are issued to foreign workers in specialized fields, and 20,000 visas are given to workers with degrees in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Last year, U.S. government data showed that Indian workers received 71% of H-1B visa approvals, followed by China with 11.1%. But with U.S. President Donald Trump's new rule to hike the H-1B visa fee to $100,000 per application, these firms are looking at other options. Namrata Darshan works in the Bengaluru office of the global AI research and advisory firm ISG. She says Indian companies relying on the H-1B visa will be fine. They weathered the storm the last time President Trump temporarily banned the H-1B visa during his first term.
I think when the H-1B restrictions came about in the first time administration itself, a lot of the companies had actually hired a lot of people onshore.
Darshan adds that with the increase of Global Capability Centers or GCCs, more Indian workers can be hired here at home. GCCs perform outsourced office functions like IT, finance, and R&D for multinational tech and financial companies. India has around 1,700 GCCs.
From an IT service standpoint, there is a lot of the companies are also catering to the GCCs now. And many of them have actually curated offerings to cater to GCCs. So a lot of the hiring will certainly happen over here.
So with options to offshore work or work in GCCs, is the American dream dead in India?
Yes, most definitely dead.
Shalika Sandeep is a working professional in India who studied in Singapore and the UK. She says Indian workers should concentrate on finding a job in the country, not the US.
I think it's not worth the effort. It's not worth the money. It's not worth an unstable future. And also the climate in the US has always been very erratic. Politically, socially, all of it, it's been very up and down.
Gulshan Kumar, a student at the Indian Institute of Science in Bengaluru, is taking that advice. Even if the salaries in the U.S. might be higher, he says the Trump administration's current policies have deterred him and many of his classmates from wanting to work or study in the U.S.
U.S. is a place that values talent. Let's say that you get selected in some job and they also pay you the amount for the H-1B visa. But let's say after 2 years, they suddenly decide we are going to hike the visa fees up. But if that kind of insecurity pops in, no one would be willing to take the risk.
Just days after Trump's new H-1B visa rules, the UK, Canada, Germany and other countries announced plans to create visas to hire more highly skilled foreign workers. China has also launched the new K visa on October 1st, which aims to attract skilled workers in science and technology. These moves are clearly aimed at India. T.V. Mohandas Pai is the chairman of the venture fund RN Capital.
No, I don't see this whole idea that India is so dependent on America, India is a weak country, is a fake narrative.
He says Trump's massive visa fee increase will only hurt the United States as Indian companies send their workers to places like Canada, Latin America and Mexico.
So you are trying to isolate and drive away the force multiplier for American technology at a time when there is the AI wave and AI needs to be implemented. It shows, in my view, a poor assessment of what America needs. A lot of innovation is happening here. So the Indian model of technology dissemination is a solution for much of the world.
Pai adds that India, a country of 1.4 billion people, is among the top four economies in the world. It is still poor in nominal terms, but he says a lot of innovations and technology are happening in the subcontinent. For the world, I'm Priyanka Shankar, Bengaluru, India.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In the 1970s in Costa Rica, a conservation area known as Guanacaste was teeming with insects. That's how ecologist Daniel Jansen remembers it anyway. He moved to Guanacaste in the 70s. He's still there today with his spouse and research partner, Winnie Hallwax. The two have been confirming the very thing scientists have been worried about, insects dying off. This is not good news, especially coming from a conservation area where species have the benefit of environmental protections. The couple got on Zoom with me this summer from their home and research base to describe the changes they've been witnessing. Daniel started by remembering how different things used to be.
When we first set up home in this national park that we live in now, there were so many insects that we had to establish a tent in our living room to work inside of at night. Wow. Because otherwise the laptop light from our screens on our laptops would just simply be swarmed with insects. Today, same door, same open, same forest. I see one insect per night, if that.
Winnie, what other changes have you noticed in terms of bug disappearance over the past decade or so?
Where we live, the sounds, the presence of insects, the interference from insects, the presence largely of large insects, it was just part of everyday life. There is absolutely no mistaking the soundscape, the sense in your body that things are hugely missing.
So, Daniel, to the question of why is this happening, I mean, these are protected forests too. Why?
Well, what was happening for hundreds of years, quite literally, is cultivation and deforestation. But those deforestations and those agricultural pesticides and other agricultural perturbations, as soon as you let that agricultural field to go back to some other kind of forest, the insects came right back. They don't do that now. Now what we're having is an overall phenomenon. It's for the forest as a whole. And what we're seeing is the impact of climate change, the heating, the drying, the change of the beginning of the rainy season, the triggers of the end of the rainy season, the length of the rainy season. So the insects are out of synchrony with the plants, as well as the small birds, the lizards, the small mammals. All of these guys are very definitely dependent on insects for their own food. So when the insects go south, when we don't have any anymore, what they end up is starving.
Daniel, you got into there kind of how this impacts other parts of the ecosystem, birds, for example. Winnie, what does it mean for humans when the insect population in their ecosystem bottoms out?
Nobody in the world really truly understands the roles that insects play in the ecosystem. People know they pollinate, but they do much, much more to a degree that we don't really know. I kind of think of them kind of like the gut microorganisms of the forest.
So Daniel, taking that into consideration, the impact on insects and their slow depletion and the impact on the environment and ultimately on humans. I mean, what worries you most as you look into the future?
Well, what worries us most, of course, is that there are small patches of forest that still remain that do have the organisms that living in them, or at least some portion of the organisms that living in them. But what we're seeing, of course, from the world today is that those are all very attractive places to cut down, to deforest. So I find myself writing papers saying, be kind to the survivors. Those little patches of forest are very fragile now. And so that anytime somebody decides they want to clear another 50 hectares of this kind of original forest, they're just doing a serious, serious damage to what used to be 25 years ago or 35 years ago, sort of incidental, because there was so much intact forest. But now there isn't any.
I would also like to make a separate point, if I may.
Yeah, please.
I want to come right out and say biodiversity in deserts, in forests, in any good habitat, loses to green energy projects. People say it's good for the planet, it will take on climate change. Especially now with Bitcoin and AI, there is an insatiable desire for energy. We can no longer afford sacrificing biodiversity, the good habitat that remains. They need a protection.
Fossil fuels also are problematic, though, for the environment, aren't they?
Yes.
So how do you square that circle?
I am glad I'm not making the decision, but I say green energy in places that are not critical habitats.
There are a lot of places that have already been totally trashed, which could be suitable for solar panels, for example, for a big solar panel project.
I mean, beyond the ecological implications, there's also an emotional component, watching species, I imagine, disappearing that you've studied your entire lives. Winnie, I gather you know entomologists who actually can't bear to gather the data anymore. Is that true?
That is true. For people who have seen what it was like, even as short a time as the year 2000, and certainly in the 1980s, they simply emotionally cannot stomach putting up, for example, a sheet with a light on, because the number of moths and other insects that come to it is so shockingly low.
If people want to help protect the insects in their own communities, what should they be doing?
What we are doing here in the Guanacaste Conservation Area is bringing in school children to teach them how the forest works, what the insects do with the plants and what the plants do with the insects, so that when they become 25 years old and they get 50 years old, they vote for leaving pieces of the wild world intact.
That's Daniel Jansen and Winnie Hallwack speaking with us this summer from their home and research base in the Guanacaste Conservation Area in Costa Rica. And now a few headlines from the world of sports.
Argentina and Puerto Rico were scheduled to play a soccer match in Chicago this week. That has been moved to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. An official with the city of Chicago blamed the move on low ticket sales. An executive with the Argentine Football Association said the blame goes to the Trump administration's immigration crackdown in Chicago.
In Australia, a former soccer team captain has pled guilty in a match-fixing scheme. Ulises Davila admitted that he and two teammates on the MacArthur Bulls deliberately earned yellow cards during a match in 2023. That was to help guarantee an outcome on a gambling website, which had a bet that the Bulls would get carded four times during that match.
And in Canada, game one of the NHL season was not too shabby for hockey star Leon Draisaitl of the Edmonton Oilers. The German scored his 400th career goal in the NHL. He's the 111th player ever to hit that milestone. Edmonton still lost, though, to Calgary.
And that's a few sports headlines for you.
There were celebrations and caution in Gaza and Israel today. We have reactions to an emerging peace deal in that war just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Returning to our top story, the peace deal that's intended to end the war in Gaza. Tonight in Israel, cabinet ministers have agreed to the terms of the U.S.-brokered ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. That means that Israeli military operations are expected to stop, that Hamas will release the 20 living hostages by Monday morning and that the remains of 28 more returned if they can be found. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu released a statement today saying, quote, "This is a diplomatic success and a national and moral victory for the state of Israel."
There are many potential roadblocks ahead for the peace framework pushed by the Trump administration, as the economist Shashank Joshi told us earlier this hour. Exactly how Hamas puts down its weapons is a major point of contention, and also,
I think aid is going to be one of the other issues. How do you deliver aid in an environment that could be very chaotic? You know, who's going to be enforcing order? Who's going to be policing sites? And then I think, what is the political status of Hamas in the region, right? Egypt, Qatar, Turkey have all played a very important role in all of this. They have all engaged with Hamas. Are they going to tell Hamas that they have to leave their countries? Are they going to tell Hamas it's all over, they have to disarm? And then finally, Gaza needs reconstruction. It's been destroyed.
Even with those looming issues, people in Israel and in Gaza have welcomed the breakthrough peace deal. We have two reports on the range of reactions from both sides of the conflict. First, the world's Shirin Jafari reports on the sense of relief in Gaza.
This is how the news of the ceasefire was relayed to the people in northern Gaza. Those living in areas with cell service shouted it in the streets, hoping others would hear them. The Israeli military ordered evacuation notices for Gaza City in the north a while ago, but some people remained. In the rest of Gaza, people have been processing the news. Taqwa Alwawi, a 19-year-old poet and writer, sent me videos of the celebrations near her home. When I ask her how she's feeling today, she hesitates.
Well, I honestly don't know where to start. I'm feeling really mixed emotions right now.
Alwawi and her family have been displaced 5 times since the beginning of the war. She says every time there's been a pause in the fighting, she got hopeful, only to be disappointed shortly after. It's difficult to process an end to the bombardment, she says, because then you have to start reflecting on everything that's been taken away.
I wish everyone I've lost, family, friends, could live this moment with me.
The Israeli military has instructed Palestinians in Gaza not to return to the north. It said the army remains in Gaza City and that returning there is, quote, extremely dangerous. But Fadi Al-Zatma, a young aid worker, tells me despite these warnings, people are eager to get back to what is left of their homes.
Some people have been waiting all night at the crossroad between north and south, just wanting to go home. But sadly, the bombing is still happening up north.
Zatma says for the first time in many months, he's feeling a sense of relief.
You know, just being able to sleep without worrying about my family or my friends feels unbelievable. It's something you cannot describe.
For a few days, Hassan Herzallah had heard whispers of the news of a possible truce, but he says he kept wondering if it's true.
As the news got more serious, my heart started to race. I couldn't stop thinking, could this really be it? Could this nightmare finally end?
When the ceasefire was finally confirmed, Herzallah says he felt something he had almost forgotten. Hope.
I looked around in our camp, people shouting, crying, hugging each other.
Herzallah says before the war, he always wanted to study English at the university, but the war derailed that dream.
I lost my university, home, and even my sense of time.
He's hoping the ceasefire means he can dream again, to return to his studies and rebuild his life somewhere peaceful. Rebuilding is going to take time and patience, says Hanin Abu Ghrara. She's been displaced 4 times since the beginning of the war. It's great that the bombings have stopped, she says, but she's not sure how she feels about the future.
I feel scared because now the war is over and I'm realizing I don't know what comes next. There's no home, no university, actually no normal life left.
Abu Ghrara says it's been tough for her mom to hear all the kids outside jumping with joy. Her 18-year-old brother, Fadi, was killed in an Israeli airstrike on their home.
My mom has been in tears ever since.
Her other brother was hit by a water truck when he went to get the family some water. They both should have been here to celebrate this moment, she says. Another grieving parent is Motasim Dalul. He says he's lost 50 of his family and relatives in this war. His son was killed only a few hours before this ceasefire was announced.
His name is Ibrahim and he's 21 years old. He was killed today, according to eyewitnesses.
Dalul says Ibrahim and a few friends had gone to the south to get some supplies, but they were hit and three of them were killed. He says he hasn't been able to retrieve his son's body because the area is too dangerous.
I am very sad that I lost my son. We were planning how to celebrate the end of the genocide.
I reached 23-year-old Saud Abu Sada in Deir al-Balah in the center of the Gaza Strip.
You can hear the sound of the kids. They are playing in the street. They are actually playing and they look so happy.
Abu Sada says he feels safe for the first time in a long while, and that makes him hopeful about the future. He says he wants to leave Gaza for Egypt.
I want to go out. I want to continue my study. I want to live my life. This was the best feel I have ever felt in my life because, as you can see, I returned back to life.
Today, the market is busy, he says, and the prices of goods have already gone down. Abu Saada's optimistic, but like many others in Gaza today, he knows things can change in the blink of an eye. Past ceasefires have broken down.
I don't want it to be like the last ceasefire that they gave us hope and they took it from us again.
He hopes this time it's different. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
And I'm Matthew Bell. Thousands of Israelis gathered in the plaza nicknamed Hostage Square in Tel Aviv to welcome the news of an imminent ceasefire. People danced and sang. They waved Israeli and American flags. Israel Berman is from a kibbutz on the Gaza border that was attacked on October 7th. He spoke to the world's producer, Tova Lazaroff, in Hostage Square earlier and says one of his neighbors from the kibbutz is still being held hostage in Gaza.
He's still there. We know he's alive. He's on the list of the 20. And we're all waiting for him to come back.
Berman says he woke up to the news this morning hoping that finally, after two long years, all the remaining hostages will go free.
I'm an optimistic guy and I believe it will happen. But there's always some crazy people on both sides that could try and kill him. I hope Trump will not allow them.
Rotem Cooper is from another kibbutz in southern Israel that was attacked by Hamas gunmen on October 7th. Both of his parents were kidnapped and taken into Gaza that day. Cooper says he feels extremely lucky because his mother was released just 2 weeks later, but he says he's pretty sure at this point that his 84-year-old father died in captivity. And that's why Cooper says today is not exactly a day of pure jubilation for Israeli families like his.
You're not going to see any big celebrations, I think, not from close family members. I think you would see probably a first really outpouring, assuming that the live one would come first. I don't know, because it's going to be very different getting, you don't celebrate when you're getting bodies in bags, okay?
Right.
Cooper says four members of his community who were kidnapped are believed to be alive. When they get out and hug their loved ones, he says, that will be something to celebrate. Gershon Baskin is a veteran Israeli peace activist. He spoke with me earlier today over the phone.
Well, I've learned from experience that the celebrations and the happiness come after it's done. It's not done until it's done, until we see the hostages coming home.
And until Palestinian prisoners are released from Israeli jails, Baskin says, then we'll begin to see if Trump's 20-point peace plan has a chance at success. When I ask him if he thinks this could mean the end of the war in Gaza and not just another temporary ceasefire, Baskin tells me he's cautiously optimistic. And like a lot of Israelis, he's giving the credit to one person in particular.
Without President Trump, this would not have happened. It's strange for me to be able to say this because I have a lot of reservations about President Trump himself, but there is no question that this deal has been made possible because President Trump made it happen.
I also talked earlier today with an Israeli combat medic. Max Kresh is part of a group of soldiers who came out against the war in Gaza. First and foremost, Kresh says he's looking forward to the hostages being freed.
But beyond just this hostage deal, we're going to need the support of the rest of the world, including the United States and President Trump, to hold our leadership accountable and make sure that they don't go back on their promises. Make sure that they are accountable for everything that's been done over this period of time, and certainly making sure that this deal holds.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has reportedly invited President Trump to deliver an address at the Knesset, and tonight Israel's parliament building in Jerusalem was lit up in red, white, and blue. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
Our coverage of the war in Gaza continues online at theworld.org and tomorrow as we look at what it takes to actually disarm Hamas.
Peru is getting a push from its neighbors in Colombia, Ecuador, and Bolivia to crack down on the illegal mining of gold. That's been even more lucrative than usual lately because the price of gold has risen dramatically. Just yesterday, the market price peaked at $4,000 an ounce. That is a nearly 150% increase from 3 years ago. The incentive for illegal mining is clear, but it's caused serious problems in Peru and for nearby communities. We asked Will Freeman to explain that. He's a fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
By illegal mining, we mean mining in areas that are off limits because they're environmentally protected, because they're indigenous lands, or simply because the miners involved haven't sought any kind of permits, don't necessarily respect any labor laws. They're essentially operating on the margins of the state.
Do you have a sense of just how much it's gone up in the past couple of years as the price of gold has skyrocketed?
Well, by nature, these are clandestine operations,
sure.
Right? The miners are trying to hide what they're doing as much as they can. What we have seen in Peru and across South America is that the gap between legally exported gold, its volume, and the volume of total gold that leaves the country, that gap has been growing. And that suggests that we're seeing more and more gold actually produced illegally. And I'll just add that experts who study this, when they put together estimates, they believe that about 50% of all illegal gold leaving Latin America is leaving just from Peru.
Oh, wow. So you've mentioned a couple of the differences between legal and illegal gold mining. Can you tell me more about what, if any, differences there are in the methods used for extraction and the environmental impact of illegal mining versus legal?
Sure. So you have what are called wildcat miners. Those are, you know, generally pretty disorganized, low-level mining gangs that go out into the Amazon jungle or into parts of the Andes. They'll use basic heavy machinery, excavators to dig tunnels, and then they'll often use mercury to separate gold from surrounding minerals. Mercury, which poisons land, which poisons water, which can have really devastating health effects on nearby communities. And that's traditionally what we've seen in Latin America since the 70s. But what we're seeing now is we're actually seeing organized crime, so transnational criminal syndicates involved in drug smuggling, people smuggling. We're seeing them also colonize the illegal gold fields. And so you're seeing this really dangerous fusion now where it's not just the wildcat miners, it's actually wildcat miners under the control of and working for gangs and cartels.
And the mercury that's used in illegal mining, that is not used in legal mining, is that right?
When it is used in legal mining, it's with generally better safeguards and clearer procedures for disposal. And what we're seeing with the illegal mining, I mean, I've been to parts of the Amazon rainforest where you have illegal miners motoring down rivers and just dumping the mercury that they're done with, the toxic sludge and waste, right back into those same rivers, killing the fish populations and leaving communities that rely on fishing, you know, to go hungry.
So this week, a trade bloc, including Peru and its neighbors, ruled that Peru has failed to meet its commitments to curb illegal gold mining. The bloc has sided with indigenous communities in determining that the damage being done to the Amazon rivers and food supply is dire. Can you talk a little bit more about what that impact is on those rivers and food supply?
You know, what you're seeing is indigenous communities having very unhealthy, elevated levels of mercury in their bloodstreams when they go in for medical checks. where you're seeing abnormalities in terms of birth defects and fortunate, you know, early miscarriages. And I think overall, you know, a really unfortunate spiral where you, as you have all these other means of making a livelihood, like fishing, agriculture, become less viable. Now the people living there are generally very poor, have more and more incentive or really pressure to start working for the illegal miners themselves. Mm.
So you mentioned that a lot of gold is coming out of Peru. Is that what sets Peru apart from its neighbors, where I presume some illegal mining is also happening?
Yeah, so definitely large amounts is happening in Venezuela and Colombia as well. But Peru is a powerhouse, one that has to do with just the amount of gold available, but also with, I think, the very lax attitude of the Peruvian government over time to this issue. Actually, the current president of the legislature in Peru, Eduardo Salwana, was working as a defense lawyer for accused illegal mining bosses when he was running for office. Mm. So there's a bending over backwards by the political class in Peru to favor the sector. Why? Because it makes them very wealthy, even as it's destroying the country.
So this ruling by this trade bloc, will it have any impact? Does it have any teeth?
It's hard for me to see it having real consequences, because we're talking about a government in Peru that's been behind dramatic democratic backsliding, which is repressing its own citizens when they come out to protest against the growth of organized crime, which is dismantling the rule of law and has rewritten a third of the constitution. Just in the past couple of years, you've seen, you know, the consolidation of a real, I would say, proto-mafia state. I don't think the will is there. There's not a government that's trying to represent its own people. It's one that's trying to act, you know, above and around them.
Mm. So more of a symbolic victory for the communities that raise this issue than anything else at this point. Let's take one step back here for our final question. Overall, around the world, is illegal gold mining increasing like it is in Peru, or have efforts to stymie it been successful?
So there have been piecemeal efforts to stymie it, but most places it's increasing. Even the conflict in Sudan between the Sudanese military and the rapid support forces, its motor is the mining of illegal gold. That's what's financing both sides in the conflict, in which many of the countries surrounding that are backing either side are siphoning money out of this economy for their own sake and their own interests. So it's unfortunately a driver of instability across large parts of Africa and South America.
Will Freeman is a fellow for Latin America Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The house where the great Czech composer Antonín Dvořák was born in 1841 has just reopened after years of renovation. It is now an interactive, immersive audio journey through the composer's early life, bringing visitors into the sounds that he heard in 1800s village life. Deutsche Welle's Rob Cameron went to the Czech countryside to get a tour of the new Dvořák Museum.
Dvořák's Symphony No. 9 in E minor from the New World, one of the most celebrated works in the history of orchestral music, composed in 1893 in New York. The New World Symphony draws inspiration from Native American melodies and African American spirituals, but there's a heavy dose of Dvořák's own Czech folk roots in there as well. The sounds of his childhood in the little village of Nela Hozovez on the river Vltava, just north of Prague. The village is still a bucolic, picturesque place, dominated by a striking Renaissance castle built in the 16th century by the Lobkowitz family. And it's the modern-day Lobkowitzes who own and run the little collection of buildings where Dvořák spent the first years of his life.
Which is the introduction room, and there's just a simple...
Musicologist Eleanor Kinski, a member of another ancient Bohemian noble family, is the curator of the Antonín Dvořák birth house. She began our tour at the wonderful diorama, a bird's-eye view of the village of Nela Hozovez.
The view is as if we were standing a bit above the birthhouse. So there's a model, and all around the model there are different triggers that are related to different buildings in the village. And we did something that was a lot of fun with an ethnomusicologist who found period and area appropriate folk songs, and we re-recorded them, and they are all according to different professions. So for instance, if you tap the village tavern, You would hear a funny song about an innkeeper. It's not a very flattering one, but it's definitely a song that would have been very popular in Dvořák's childhood.
Dvořák spent just 12 years in Nelahozovez and only the first six in this building, the village inn that his father ran. But Eleanor Kinski says the little Bohemian village had a deep effect on him.
Later, he passed by Nelahozovez very often because there's a railway going through the village. And any time that Dvořák would go to visit his publisher Simrock in Berlin, or even travel to the UK and even to the US, he would actually pass by train through Nelahozovez.
My father loved the zither. Sometimes...
This was the sitting room of the tavern. So this is where people would meet up, drink beer, play cards, discuss the latest town gossip. And this is basically also the theme of this room. Since Antonín was the eldest son, he had for sure to help out in his parents' business, and he must have seen a lot of drunk elderly men and observed the music also that happened. We know that František Dvořák, so Antonín's father, was a very gifted zither player and that he played often for his guests.
And there is a zither here on the table.
There is a zither that we had made especially for the exhibition, so you can actually try and play on the zither. So it's everything in the exhibition can be touched, and you are even encouraged to do so. But we also know that little Antonín sometimes played together with his father some of the popular folk songs. So this room was a family room, so it was one of the only rooms the family actually could use just by themselves that didn't serve to any tavern purposes. And this is why we think, or we believe, that that Anna Dvořáková gave birth to her son in this very room.
The soothing rhythm of the rocking cradle. I watched my mother rock my brothers and sisters.
This exquisite, immersive exhibition was created by Ralph Applebaum Associates, one of the world's premier museum and exhibition design firms. At the launch, I caught up with Tim Ventimiglia, who runs the Berlin studio that designed the Dvořák House, and his colleague, Anne-Meike Evert, who worked on the content.
Well, this was a really remarkable assignment because we are standing on the authentic birthplace of Antonín Dvořák, and the authenticity of place was our greatest asset. Conjuring that atmosphere of his early life was really our task, and how to do that through different design disciplines without a lot of objects. How do we connect this place to his creative compositions, and how do we bring his voice to life? That was our task.
I think it was one of the most creative processes we ever had, because the museum is about creativity and how you foster that and how the environment can foster that and get you to experience things that lead to musical expressions.
Dvořák died in Prague in 1904 at the age of 62, but he left behind a huge body of work: symphonic poems, choral pieces, concertos, operas, and chamber works. Eleanor Kinski says it's hard to overstate his contribution to Czech cultural heritage.
He's probably the most cosmopolitan of all the Czech composers, even crossing the big ocean and going to the US. And nowadays, I would say, he is one of the few composers that brings Czech culture and Czech music abroad, which is something he did while living and still today.
But in life and in work, he never forgot the little village of his childhood, the sound of his father playing the zither, the bells of the Church of St. Andrew, the ferry crossing the Vltava River. And you can hear all of that here in this modest collection of houses, a short trip along the river from Prague. This is Rob Cameron in Nelahozovez.
That story was reported by our partners Deutsche Welle for the DW program Inside Europe. Find it and us wherever you listen to podcasts.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Jan Elizabeth, Jane Johnson, Kira and Peter McGrath, Leslie Meadowcroft, Maggie Walker, Ravi Mohan, and Rich Gorlick. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.